Lecture 15, Eliot and the Unfolding of Character.
We ended our first lecture on George Eliot by examining her portrayal of characters like Dorothea Brooke, ambitious people of the sort who had never appeared in English fiction before. In this lecture, we will continue to explore Eliot's treatment of character. In other words, we'll once again consider the psychological dimension of her fiction. Eliot shows how circumstances and accidents help to shape our personalities. If only one or two things had been different, if you were tall instead of short, if you had a brother instead of a sister, she says, you might be a very different person, a completely different person. Eliot's also interested in the effect of personal experiences on the development of personality. For her, the personality is never fixed or finished. As the narrator of Middlemarch, her most famous novel, explains, character or personality is a process and an unfolding. Eliot's views on these matters are evident in her handling of all the characters. For the sake of convenience and a few other reasons that may emerge over time, we'll focus this lecture on three of her men. They are Dr. Tertius Lydgate, who at the beginning of the novel has only recently arrived in town. Edward Casaubon, a clergyman and scholar, the first heroine, the first husband to Eliot's heroine, Dorothea Brooke, and Nicholas Bulstrode, a banker and community leader. Lydgate and Casaubon were mentioned in our first lecture, but Bulstrode was not, so it might make sense for me to say just a bit about him now. I'll begin by noting that he's both controlling and judgmental, immediately dislikable, in other words. One of the least attractive aspects of Bulstrode's character is his self-righteous piety. He has a holier-than-thou attitude and seems to enjoy pointing out the spiritual failings of others. In Bulstrode, as in Dorothea then, we see Eliot's interest in religious feeling. How does belief or faith fit into the human personality, the human life? That's a pressing question for her, and her continued attention to it is another one of the things that distinguish her from earlier novelists. In the works of writers from Richardson to Dickens, characters might quote from the Bible or even attend church regularly, but their spiritual lives are not treated in much detail. Eliot changes that, frequently giving close attention to the religious experiences of her characters. And here I might note, she goes beyond the question of God's existence. Eliot's religious characters are more concerned with the consequences of faith, the role of religion in daily human life. Do your religious beliefs oblige you to renounce all sensual pleasures? Should your beliefs bring you closer to other people, or should they set you apart from others? Do you need to provide a spiritual example to your fellow men? These are the kinds of questions treated with great sensitivity in Eliot. With all of that in mind, let's turn our attention to Middlemarch, and more specifically, to Dr. Lydgate. At the beginning of the novel, Lydgate is still only 27 years old. He is another orphan, but like Dorothea, he comes from a distinguished family. Indeed, his aristocratic connections set him apart from others in his profession. Here we might note that the medical profession was not then what it is now. In the late 1820s and early 1830s, the period in which Middlemarch is set, medicine had advanced beyond the days of barber, surgeons, and apothecaries, but not as far as you might think. The medical profession was still largely unregulated. As late as 1858, there were 21 different licensing bodies in operation. An important piece of legislation passed in 58 changed all of that. Compared with other countries, say Scotland or France, England was definitely a little backward. So it's significant that Eliot has Dr. Lydgate study in Edinburgh and Paris, as well as in London. Eliot did an enormous amount of research for Middlemarch, and much of it was focused on the history of medicine. In preparing to write about Lydgate, she read through issues of The Lancet, the leading British medical journal, dating back to the 1820s. The journal may still be in operation today. Elliot was especially interested in the conflict between physicians whose medical practices were based on tradition, maybe even on folk wisdom, and younger doctors who took a more scientific approach. In describing the established older physicians in Middlemarch, her narrator reminds us that, quote, the heroic times of copious bleeding and blistering had not yet departed, still less the times of thoroughgoing theory, when disease in general was called by some bad name and treated accordingly without shilly-shally. The narrator also explains that medical practice then, quote, chiefly consisted in giving a great many drugs. In that situation, she says, the public inferred that it might be better off with more drugs still if they could only be got cheaply, and hence swallowed large cubic measures of physic prescribed by unscrupulous ignorance, which had taken no degrees. In describing Lydgate, Eliot leaves no doubt that he's on the side of progress and reform, which is to say, on the side of science. To be sure, Lydgate does not overlook the art of medicine. In fact, the narrator tells us that he goes into medicine precisely because it presents the most perfect interchange between science and art, offering the most direct alliance between intellectual conquest and the social good. The narrator also tells us that Lydgate has genuine concern for his sick patients. He cared not only for cases, she says, but for John and Elizabeth, especially Elizabeth. And there the narrator is hinting at the fact that Lydgate has a weakness for the ladies. Lydgate's humanity is in fact the inspiration for his obsession with recent scientific advances, especially in the field of anatomy. And Eliot researched all of that material too. It was a time of great discovery in this field. Indeed, Lydgate wants to make his own contribution to the field, and he's hoping it will be a big one. Let's listen to the way in which the narrator describes those hopes, those ambitions. Lydgate was ambitious above all, she says, to contribute towards enlarging the scientific, rational basis of his profession. The more he became interested in special questions of disease, such as the nature of fever or fevers, the more keenly he felt the need for that fundamental knowledge of structure. And let me just pause there and underscore that phrase, because it'll turn out to be important later on. The fundamental knowledge of structure, which just at the beginning of the century had been illuminated by the brief and glorious career of Bechet. And here I might briefly note that Bechet was a French anatomist who lived from 1771 to 1802. Now, as the narrator reviews the achievements of Bechet, recall some of what we were saying about Dickens and the multiplot novel. At first, this may seem like a stretch, but I think you'll see where we're going. Chaos and even randomness on the surface, connection and coherence and order underneath. The same distinction for Bechet and Lydgate has got to be at work in the body. Thus, Lydgate's work, as many critics have noted, bears a striking resemblance to that of a novelist like Eliot. Speaking of Bechet, the narrator says that he first carried out the conception that living bodies, fundamentally considered, are not associations of organs, which can be understood by studying them first apart and then, as it were, federally, but must be regarded as consisting of certain primary webs or tissue out of which the various organs, brain, heart, lungs, and so on, are compacted. So, even though the organs look different and perform very different anatomical functions, Bechet thinks that they must all be made out of the same stuff, the same substance. So now the question for Bechet and people who follow him is just, what is that substance? If it exists, and, you know, it has to exist, it must exist, then how can it be discovered and described? These are the questions that excite and inspire Lydgate, who is, it turns out, planning to conduct scientific research of his own. Lydgate's dream is to be the one who discovers that primitive tissue, the substance from which the organs of the human body are all made. In our first lecture on Middlemarch, I suggested that Eliot endows her characters and her fiction with an unprecedented sense of intellectual seriousness. By now, I hope you can see why. In continuing to develop this point, I'd just like to say that Eliot is eager to describe the moment when Lydgate committed himself to science and to medicine. We are not afraid of telling over and over again, the narrator says, how a man comes to fall in love with a woman and be wedded to her or else be fatally parted from her. And in the story of intellectual passions, the development also varies. Now let's just stop for a moment and consider what's going on in that passage. In that passage, Eliot's narrator is addressing the traditional importance of the courtship plot, noting that we have heard over and over again about how people fall in love, about how people get married, and then going on to say, but how do people choose their profession, their vocation? Why aren't there novels, stories dealing with that subject? That's what I'm going to try to do in Middlemarch, she seems to be saying. That's the kind of story that I'd like to write. Eliot gives due attention to the role of chance or accident in the development of Lydgate's professional ambitions and intellectual passions. And that's the main point I'd like to emphasize in this next part of the lecture. Eliot explains that Lydgate's vocation is the result of an accident, his childhood discovery of an encyclopedia article on human anatomy. It happened when he was 10 years old, the narrator explains. It was a rainy day, and Lydgate decided to occupy himself with some old books in the family library. I'm summarizing here. He'd always enjoyed reading, and so he takes down the volumes of an old encyclopedia, begins reading the article on anatomy, and he's hooked for life. Now we'll go into the novel. The moment of vocation had come, the narrator says. And before he got down from his chair, the world was made new to him. From that hour, Lydgate felt the growth of an intellectual passion. So, if the weather had been nice, or if he'd pulled down another volume of the encyclopedia, everything might have been different. The point is important to Eliot, who is careful to tell us how other circumstances contributed to the shaping of Lydgate's personality. If his parents had not died when he was a boy, for example, they might have felt a medical career incompatible with the family dignity. And this is another point that might seem curious to us. Right now, we, think that going into medicine is a big deal. Back then, it wasn't quite so clear. In Eliot's handling of such details, we may once again see her debt to Austen. In the opening paragraphs of Emma, as we've noted, Austen shows how various factors have united in the formation of Emma's personality. These factors include her beauty, her intelligence, her social position, and her wealth. Birth order figures into it. Her father's personality, her governess's personality, those things figure into it. Had any of those things been different, Austen suggests, Emma's personality would have been different as well. In addition to noting the impact of accidents and circumstances, Eliot traces the unfolding of Lydgate's personality. She shows us how he changes over time. Eliot's narrator tells us that while studying medicine in Paris, Lydgate became involved with a French actress, proposing marriage only to discover that she may have murdered her first husband. Despite his determination to take a strictly scientific view of women, Lydgate jumps into marriage shortly after arriving in Middlemarch, agreeing to an engagement with Rosamond Vincey, the beautiful blonde daughter of the mayor. To outside observers, it probably looks like a great marriage. Lots and lots of people have been lining up to take a crack at Rosamond. Handsome young doctor, ambitious fellow, beautiful blonde girl, prettiest young woman in town. In reality, as we're allowed to see, the marriage is a disaster. Lydgate and Rosamond do not share the same values. They can't communicate, and it doesn't help that they're both stubborn. The middle sections of the novel include a number of wrenching scenes between them, and though our sympathies are generally with Lydgate, we sense that at least he's trying to make the marriage work, We cannot excuse him from responsibility for some of the trouble. Here, Eliot is borrowing from Thackeray and Dickens, who had, in various works, explored the internal dynamics of unhappy marriages. How does love give way to bitterness or resentment? Why do some couples stop communicating? And what happens in that situation when divorce is not an option? That was indeed the case in Victorian Britain, by the way. Through the first half of the century, it took an act of Parliament to make a divorce, or more precisely, a divorce settlement, truly legal. Some loosening came with the Matrimonial Causes Act of 1857, which allowed for divorce on specified grounds. You had to give cause. As you'll recall, G.H. Lewes, Eliot's partner, had grounds for seeking divorce in his wife's adultery. Even so, divorce was incredibly rare. In the year of 1913, so 40 years after Eliot writes Middlemarch, there were, in all of England and Wales, only 577 official divorces. 577 in all of England and Wales. The consequences of making a bad marriage were very, very serious then, and that fact helps to explain the growing interest in such unions on the part of our mid-Victorian novelists. In Eliot's novel, Lydgate and Rosamond do stay together and do find ways of managing their disagreements. To pay off their mounting debts, however, Lydgate is forced to give up his scientific research and enter a more lucrative medical practice. At the end of the novel, we're told that although he later enjoyed worldly success as a physician in London, he always, quote, regarded himself as a failure and, quote, died prematurely of diphtheria. A sad ending for this person then. In Lydgate's case, to sum up, we're dealing not only with a single set of circumstances, the happy accident of the rainy day and the encyclopedia article, but rather with a chain of events. The affair with the actress leads to the resolution to avoid entanglements with women, which in turn leads to the impulsive engagement as well as the unhappy marriage. Eliot does not suggest that Lydgate's personality is infinitely malleable. His basic nature is passionate, and she is quick to say so. Nevertheless, she shows us that the development of his personality is a continuous process, one that ends only in death. Now, before we move away from Lydgate, there is one other point I'd like to make. In earlier lectures, and really through the whole course, we've noticed the importance of comedic endings. And a big part of the comedic ending is, of course, the idea of poetic justice, the idea that virtue is rewarded, vice is punished to appropriate degrees. In looking at Lydgate, it's hard to get a sense that poetic justice has been accomplished. This fellow may have made some mistakes. He may have rushed into marriage hastily, but he certainly doesn't deserve sort of endless trouble and torment with his wife. He doesn't deserve to have to set aside all of his dreams and aspirations. He doesn't deserve to die at such a young age. All of that seems unfair. In addition to Lydgate, Eliot devotes considerable attention to characters like Edward Casaubon and Nicholas Bulstrode. These may indeed be some of her most original creations. Both of these figures are middle-aged and thus strikingly different from the youthful protagonists of most English novels. What's more, they are conflicted and tormented men, capable of hurting others as well as themselves. Casaubon hurts Dorothea largely through suspicion and mistrust. Though pretentious and vain, he is also deeply insecure, afraid of being exposed as a failure. He does have reason to worry. Casaubon has been working for years on a massive scholarly project. He's undertaken to show, as the narrator explains, that all the mythical systems or erratic mythical fragments in the world were originally corruptions of a tradition originally revealed. What Casaubon wants to do is recreate that original tradition, to write what he thinks of as the key to all mythologies. It's an ambitious project, and as I say, it's occupied him for years. His notes already made a formidable range of volumes, the narrator explains. But the crowning task would be to condense these voluminous, still accumulating results and bring them, like the earlier vintage of Hippocratic books, to fit a little shelf. As we consider Kasabin's project, we need to keep several things in mind. First, there's the resemblance between his key to all mythologies and Lydgate's primitive tissue. Both of these men are seeking to discover order and unity beneath a chaotic surface. Second, there's the fact that Dorothea expects to play a part, a really active part, in his research. She's chosen to marry Kasabin not because he's handsome or charming, after all, but because she wants to be a part of something larger, something really grand. Finally, there's the fact that Kasabin is never going to finish his work. He's the kind of scholar who can't stop taking notes and can't ever get around to actually writing. His problems are compounded by the fact that he refuses to consult the best sources. As Dorothea learns from Kasabin's cousin, Will Ladislaw, German scholars have already done most of the legwork here and done it well. And Dorothea's aghast at this. This revelation punctures her illusions and spoils her vision of her new husband, so it's understandable that she asks Will to explain. "I merely mean," he says, "that the Germans have taken the lead in historical inquiries, and they laugh at results which are got by groping about in the woods with a pocket compass while they have made good roads." "When I was with Mr. Kasabin," Will adds, "I saw that he deafened himself in that direction. It was almost against his will that he read a Latin treatise written by a German. I was very sorry." So, not only is Mr. Kasabin an overcautious scholar, he's a biased one as well. He refuses to consult the leading authorities on his own subject. What's more, he's been confronted with the fact of his bias, and he's chosen not to do anything about it. His preferred strategy, the narrator suggests, is to go on working, pretending that nothing's wrong, to hope that no one will notice his limitations or point out his mistakes. Kasabin has been living this way for most of his adult life, usually managing to hide his insecurities from others. But after his marriage, further concealment becomes impossible. His wife knows, and as time passes, he begins to suspect that she knows. As Kasabin takes out his many frustrations on Dorothea, we are torn. Though we do not approve of his behavior, we can also see that his situation is desperate. Eliot wants us to realize that Kasabin's abuse of Dorothea originates not in vanity, but rather in shame and fear. We must conclude that although Kasabin brings great pain to Dorothea, he may experience an even greater disappointment himself. It would be terrible to be in Dorothea's situation, we feel, but perhaps even worse to be in Kasabin's. The narrator makes this point in a wonderful passage. "Kasabin's experience," she says, "his experience was of that pitiable kind which shrinks from pity and fears most of all that it should be known. It was that proud, narrow sensitiveness which has not mass enough to spare for transformation into sympathy and quivers thread-like in small currents of self-preoccupation or, at best, of an egoistic scrupulosity. For my part, I am very sorry for him. It is an uneasy lot at best to be what we call highly taught and yet not to enjoy. To be present at this great spectacle of life and never to be liberated from a small, hungry, shivering self, never to be fully possessed by the glory we behold, never to have our consciousness rapturously transformed into the vividness of a thought, the ardor of a passion, the energy of action, but always to be scholarly and uninspired, ambitious and timid, scrupulous and dim-sighted. Becoming a dean or even a bishop would make little difference, I fear, to Mr. Kasabin's uneasiness. Doubtless some ancient Greek has observed that behind the big mask and the speaking trumpet, there must always be our poor little eyes peeping as usual and our timorous lips more or less under anxious control. Eventually, as his health fails, Kosaban turns to Dorothea for help. Finally, he offers to make her a partner in his scholarship. He hasn't granted her this opportunity before, but now he needs her help. And the only trouble is, she no longer wants the job. She wrestles with this decision, and as she's heading out into their garden, ready to tell him that she will try to complete his work, she discovers him slumped over in the summer house, dead. This, I have to say, is the most famous reprieve in the history of the English novel. Not only is Dorothea freed from the obligation to continue her husband's worthless scholarship, she's freed from marriage to him as well. As we noted in our first lecture on Eliot, she eventually remarries and enjoys true happiness with Will Ladislaw. After resolving Kosaban's story with his death, Eliot moves on to the more difficult case of Nicholas Bulstrode. Now a pillar of his church, Bulstrode is hiding dark secrets. Years ago, as a young man, Bulstrode inherited a fortune from his first wife after concealing information about her estranged daughter. The fortune really belonged to the daughter. He found the daughter, who had moved away from home years ago, but instead of revealing her whereabouts, he kept that information to himself so that he could inherit the money. The past is now catching up with Bulstrode, and as he confronts the threat of exposure, he is tormented. He knows that he has cheated his stepdaughter, and he also knows that it's too late for him to set things right. Moreover, he's not sure that he really wants to set things right, and this is where it gets so complicated and interesting. He has enjoyed many advantages because of the inheritance from his first wife, and he is not ready to give them up. Here's how the narrator puts it. There were hours in which Bulstrode felt that his action was unrighteous, but how could he go back? He had mental exercises, called himself naught, laid hold on redemption, and went on in his course of instrumentality. There may be coarse hypocrites who consciously affect beliefs and emotions for the sake of gulling the world, but Bulstrode was not one of them. He was simply a man whose desires had been stronger than his theoretic beliefs, and who had gradually explained the gratification of his desires into satisfactory agreement with those beliefs. If this be hypocrisy, it is a process which shows itself occasionally in us all, to whatever confession we belong, and whether we believe in the future perfection of our race or in the nearest date fixed for the end of the world, whether we regard the earth as a putrefying nidus for a saved remnant, including ourselves, or have a passionate belief in the solidarity of mankind. And in this passage, she forces us to recognize our kinship with Bulstrode. We may not have done anything, you know, exactly like his bad acts, but we can't pretend that we haven't engaged in the same sort of rationalization. As Bulstrode's world collapses, and he's forced to leave Middlemarch in disgrace, we cannot help but feel that he's getting what he deserves. As with Kosaban, we also share his pain and wonder what it would be like to be in his situation. What would it be like to spend your life with a terrible secret? How would you cope with the knowledge that you cheated another person? How might you justify your actions to yourself? These are the questions that Eliot raises through her portrayal of Bulstrode. As we consider them, we can see why Virginia Woolf described Middlemarch as, quote, one of the few English novels written for grown-up people. In our next lecture, we'll turn from Eliot to Thomas Hardy, a writer on whom she had considerable influence.